Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
A man charged with allegedly killing 7 women across nearly 2 decades on Long Island is now expected to walk into a courtroom and plead guilty. After almost 3 years of maintaining his innocence, after his defense fought to throw out DNA, split the case into separate trials, dismiss a murder charge for insufficient evidence, and point the finger at another convicted killer, Rex Huerman reportedly has decided to stop fighting. The question nobody can stop asking is, why now? And whether this was always inevitable or whether the prosecution boxed him into a corner that he couldn't think his way out of. Joining me to discuss this new development in this horrific case, Eric Faddis, former prosecutor, defense attorney, and of course, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program for the FBI. Eric, let's start here. A man stands before a court for nearly 3 years saying he did not do this, and then reportedly decides to plead guilty to 7 murders from someone who's sat on both sides of this. Eric, what exactly is happening inside of those conversations between Rex and his attorney that seems to have brought us to this?
Sure, Tony. So, you know, from the outset with a client, you kind of have a strategic plan. You're kind of like, hey, we're going to explore these defenses. We're going to assert these potential constitutional violations. We're going to file these motions, and we're going to try to improve your legal position. But as the trial is looming and as it gets closer, reality starts to really kick in. And the client hopefully kind of appreciates their exposure at that juncture. And it's not uncommon for plea agreements to happen once trial is getting closer and people start to get freaked out.
So, Eric, what do you think he's pleading for on this one? I guess that's the huge question. You know, there's so many questions in this one, but, you know, inside New York, no death penalty. So it's not like the Koberger case where they're trying to leverage life, you know, for Koberger with a plea deal. So that's not in it. And the Son of Sam law, I researched it, but you probably know this better than me. So I'm curious about your take on whether this impacted or not. So Son of Sam law says that he cannot profit from any proceeds from his story, but his family can, according to the law. But it really depends, I guess, on what the judge says. Is that true? I mean, what do you think was the motivation?
Yeah, good question. There could be certain provisions included within a plea agreement whereby Huerman could not benefit in some form or fashion from selling his story to HBO or something like that. But yeah, what is his incentive? Because there's not death on the table, and usually the step down from that is life without the possibility of parole. I can't imagine that they're offering some sort of cap on prison time, like a cap of 40 years or something. But then again, you know, he might just kind of be done and ready to resolve this and sort of see the writing on the wall. But what are the benefits he might be trying to seek? Those are a little bit unclear. I don't know if it's prison placement. I don't know if it's
is that on the table, do you think? No, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. Does the judge have the ability, or does the court have the ability to do prison placement?
It usually depends on the jurisdiction. Oftentimes not. Oftentimes right. It's up to the Bureau of Prisons. But there are certain things that can be written into a plea agreement that might be valuable to Rex. And so perhaps those are being negotiated presently.
I mean, even if they do have some sort of initial set of like, okay, we're going to send you off to this prison here, isn't that ultimately always up to the Bureau of Prisons at the end of the day? I mean, like, okay, well, initially we'll send you here. Couldn't that just switch at any moment in time? Maybe I'm completely off on this, but I don't believe that, you know, at some point in time, they were like, well, no, we can't move this prisoner because of the part of the plea agreement says he's going to be housed here indefinitely. Is that ever part of it?
You bring up a good point, because usually the court does not have jurisdiction over the Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah.
So it can't tell the prison what to do. It can make a recommendation.
Yeah.
It can say, hey, you know, it's the court's hope that the Bureau of Prisons, you know, accommodates what's listed in the plea agreement. But yeah, that's not set in stone, and it's not something that's really enforceable. It's really aspirational.
People roll the dice all the time when it comes to this sort of stuff, especially when it comes to like proffer agreements and things like that, where they're going to sit there and I'll give you your information that you need. And at the end of the day, I'm going to get this out of it. I'm not going to be prosecuted, or, you know, like we saw in the example of the au pair affair recently, where everyone thought, oh, well, she's just going to go back to her country of origin after that. Nope. Surprise. You get 10 years because it wasn't completely in stone. It was suggested. Maybe you'll get this, but at the end of the day, someone can still make a decision. It's a strong suggestion, and suggestions aren't necessarily set in stone. Do you think is this where he's at, where he's at this big of a disadvantage, where it's like, well, I'm going to hope that maybe I get a good suggestion here, and have little to no control over anything. Is this how little control this man has left? And is this him trying to grasp at that last little hair of it? Pardon the pun.
You know, that very well could be. And Tony, as you and Robin know, there are other killings within this vicinity over the course of time for which Rex Furrowman was suspected. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps there's something like, I'm just speculating, but if he, you know, cops to these 7 murders, if that's what the plea agreement looks like, then he could somehow have immunity from the additional suspected killings. You know, is that really a tangible benefit for him? I don't know, but it's an optics benefit. It may help his family in some form or fashion, may reduce potential restitution that he and his family would have to pay. So there are some bargaining chips, but they're very small.
You know, that'll be really interesting, Eric, because so if you're going down the road of what a typical, I don't know if you want to use the word typical, serial killer is, a lot of them are about that, you know, that large narcissistic, sociopathic grandiosity, always looking for more. You know, BTK is a great example. Grandiosity, look at me, I'm the best, I did this. I really wonder if that was part of that calculation, that mind of his is like, all right, I'm not going to get away with this, but if I get a plea deal and I don't have to be charged with more, and I can try to get a suggestion of where I get to live, and my family gets to profit from the stories, if he feels compelled to put out more, if his driving focus is that grandiosity and being like the best at this, that might have played into it, I wonder. Just like he feels at liberty then to start trickling and exposing this, and this. That's an interesting take on it. I wonder if that'll play into it. It'll be interesting. And also, what do you think the victims' families were thinking about this? Are that you think they're part of this discussion, this dialogue? And what do you think the impact of them is going to be from your experience?
Yeah, that ego piece could very well be a part of it. You know, maybe there's some subjective, perverse benefit to him in saying that, hey, you caught me for these ones, but I know in my mind you didn't catch me for these other ones. Now, I'm not saying he necessarily did the other killings, but there's a strong suspicion. So, and then in terms of the victims' families, yeah, they by law typically have to be involved in the plea negotiation process, have to receive notice of it, have to have an opportunity to give their position on what the plea offer might be.
What do you think this is going to be?
With this many potential homicides, I can't fathom the prosecutor doing anything but life without the possibility of parole. And like I said, maybe there are some minor concessions that they could give him if he's willing to cop to that.
All right. Thanks.
We're trying to figure out, you know, what inspired him to take this route. We got the housing area, you know, maybe there's something with that. Do you think any of this comes down to his family? Do you think there's any emotional lever here that he has decided to pull that that this somehow is to protect his family from going through this trial, and in all that they're going to be drugged through and all the extra exposure that they're going to face? Do you think it ended up being a conversation? Because apparently Asa's still been visiting him in prison. I mean, in the doc that was made more than a year ago, in the doc she said that she called him his hero. I have no idea what Asa's opinion of him is today, and it could easily have changed within the course of a year. But I do wonder if there's something there of he's doing this, you know, on the surface for them, but maybe at the end, it's more so it will prevent a trial, and it will prevent them, maybe even her, I don't know, from possibly exposing Rex for other crimes. I mean, I'm wondering if there's something there. And I'm not accusing Asa of committing any crimes or anything of that nature, but it does seem like she is a bit of a vulnerability to him. Because whether she knows it or not, she knows more about Rex than most people do. And she would be able to connect some dots and expose him probably in ways that she's not even aware that she'd be exposing him, but he is. And I'm wondering if there's something there, that there was a lever and it makes strategic sense for him. Maybe he was pressured into confessing by her to not be put through this. And he's rolling the dice going, my odds are better if it'll keep her shut up more and her less in the spotlight if we just kind of get this stuff, you know, pushed through and wrapped up.
Tony, that's kind of where my head went too, because like you said, the wife Asa has been kind of by his side, at least it's certainly early on, or at least supportive, and not something we often see in cases like this. And so, yeah, was it some sort of way to protect the family from this crucible of trial? You know, they've already had to deal with so much due to Rex's alleged actions, but you know, over time, 5-10 years from now, that can blow over. However, if there is a nationally publicized multi-week trial, multi-month trial potentially, that goes into the nauseating details of everything Rex did, and that could reflect on the family, maybe he wants to protect them from that. Maybe he's even vying for some kind of immunity for his family if there is any sort of suspicions in terms of knowledge or complicity or something else.
Yeah, I tell you, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you have these incredibly psychopathic serial killers, which typically don't have empathy. They feign empathy so they can victimize people. And a lot of them are just pure actors. But then you see these behaviors like BTK. I know we keep bringing it up because there's so much similarities here. You really wonder, is there a true bond with the human beings in his life, especially because, you know, to your point, Eric, the children. You know, maybe he doesn't want his daughter and his son exposed to the true horrors of everything he did because of that. I wonder if that did weigh on him at all when making that decision.
Yeah, very well could be. I mean, these people are human. Now, you know,
barely.
Some people use that term loosely, but they still have at least the theoretical capacity for those emotions.
You know, Robin, you say, you know, does he have a bond there with his kids and his wife or his ex-wife and all that? There's a bond, but what is that bond?
Yeah, is it a tool?
Is it a lever that he can pull? Is it a transactional bond? Because a lot of people have bonds that on the surface, to the rest of us who don't have transactional bonds, and the bonds are there because we genuinely care and we have love and relationships that are built on those, you know, tenets of life and meaning that build true, strong relationships. And there's people who have surface bonds that are built on transaction. And I think sometimes those folks who live in a world, in a life where their relationships are solely based on transaction, they don't even contemplate a deeper meaning. They think everybody works on transaction. And I'm wondering if that's part of it. If, like I was saying, if there is a transactional detail to that relationship with his family that somehow it works to his advantage to make this specific move. The other aspect of this that I come to wonder about is kind of the Koberger aspect of it. Why did Koberger do this at the very last minute, too, at the 11th hour? I mean, basically, the evidence was there. He was going to be crucified, and the mask was going to not only slip, it was going to be ripped off and exposed, whether he liked it or not. And I'm wondering if there's an aspect to Rex Heuermann like that, too, where, I mean, this was a very, very secretive man. At least nobody was digging deep enough for a majority of his existence. And I'm wondering if all those secrets that he spent decades trying to protect. I mean, a lot of them have already been revealed, but we're going to get in there deep if this went to trial. Every little aspect, every piece of dust, all of it is going to come out. And exposure to personalities like this, and it's hard to read him completely and his personality type, but if he is anywhere along the dark triad and has some of the narcissism going on there, that removal of the mask is like kryptonite. That's the worst possible thing. You really want them to feel shame or whatever it is that makes them feel bad, that would be the way to do it. And if you're going to have this done seven times over in a courtroom for seven different victims, I wonder if his give a shit just kind of got to a point of like, I can't take that. That's too much.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tony. I'm highly skeptical as well of him using, and he might even say it, or they'll put out a release like he's doing it for his family, but I seriously doubt he has the capacity to do it because, like you said, transactional. Yeah. And also with these serial killers, I mean, that imagery that they do for their own wacky sexual satisfaction of their trophies and how they align them and place them in woods or whatever they're doing, to have that no longer secret, it kind of bursts that bubble of theirs in their mind and that fantasy world they're living out. And so if it all gets exposed, he's left with nothing going to jail. So I think that's probably more likely, like you and Eric were saying.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at briefly the like the Zodiac killer, for example, that person got off on the fact that they weren't going to be found out. You're not going to learn the details of what they're doing. You're not going to get into the inner workings of that. And when that is exposed, as Creative Chaosify said in the comments, that rips the control from Rex Heuermann, too. This could be a way that he still maintains control over those details.
I mean, that's the other aspect. I mean, this is, I'm sorry, Robin, it's a lever of control that he's trying to pull because he has none. And the extreme level of control that this guy operated under, I mean, it was almost comically bad where he like literally writing notes, like take the head, cut off the tat. Like if you're doing this, you really need notes to remind you like, oh shoot, I forgot I was supposed to take the head. Darn it.
Part of the fantasy. Yeah.
If only that was on notes. I'll put a post-it about it next time. And he does. There's another element to this. The judge still has to accept the plea. Eric, talk about this. This is like a legal end to this. What would make the judge reject it? Can he reject it? Is that a real possibility or is that just a formality at this point?
Oh, it's definitely a real possibility. And I've seen countless pleas rejected by judges. You know, judges usually have substantial discretion in that, Tony. And it's kind of like, does the judge think this is fair? Does the judge think this is just under the circumstances? Now, oftentimes the judge will go along with a mutually agreed upon plea agreement, especially if the victim's families are in favor. But if for some reason, if the victim's families presented at court during the plea hearing and said, hey, this is not fair. It needs to be more serious in some fashion. The judge could say, hey, we've got, you know, a multiplicity of killings over the course of decades. And, you know, these concessions or whatever is built into the plea that might benefit Rex, the judge might not want that. So it could be rejected.
Yeah. Is that typically what sways the lever of influence on the judge is families or is it something else about whether to accept it or not accept it? You know, in your experience, what is the driving factor?
That the family's position plays a huge role. And you know, the judges want to do their best to do right by these victims' families. So that could absolutely, that's usually the driving factor when a plea is rejected.
Right. if he wants to plead guilty here, the judge can obviously reject the terms that they come to and say, nope, here's what it is. There are no concessions for him. It's exactly what I'm going to say it's going to be. Take it or leave it. And Rex could take it or leave it. He can't necessarily force a trial to take place if Rex is going to plead guilty. I guess only if Rex were to not agree to whatever the plea agreement would be what would force a trial, correct?
That's correct. If Rex didn't agree to it, he would still have his right to a trial, and he can always change his mind, even if there is an agreement in place.
Yeah.
Things could change.
So many interesting angles to this. Just in your opinion, do you see a world here where the judge may reject whatever comes down the line? Number one, the prosecutors would, you know, be kind of rolling the dice a little bit if they're going to bring something to a judge that they think may be rejected. I'm going to think they're probably going to bring something that they're pretty confident in would be agreed upon to, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You always consider that as a prosecutor. You're like, hey, if I extend this plea offer, it's meaningless if the judge doesn't agree to it. And so you've got to have that forward thinking of like, hey, is the judge going to view this as acceptable? So I would anticipate that. But if there is any cap on prison, for example, even like 40 years, like up to 40 years in prison, I wouldn't be surprised if a judge looks at that and says, that's too lenient. Things can happen in prison. Sentences can be reduced. He might get out later. I'm not going to accept that. I wouldn't be surprised if a judge took such a position.
That's interesting. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down Rex Heerman and his supposed plea deal that has not yet taken place, but we are in anticipation of. Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description to continue the conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Investigators pulled a deleted Word document off Rex Heerman's hard drive, allegedly created in around 2000, modified over several years with sections on supplies, problems, disposal sites, and targets. They matched his DNA to hairs found on and near multiple victims using a technology never before admitted in a New York courtroom. And they built the initial connection from a pizza crust he threw in the trash while being surveilled. When you lay down those pieces side by side, the question isn't whether the prosecution had a case, it's whether the defense ever even had a chance. Eric Faddis is with us to help break down where this case is at and where it's going. Prosecutors, they recovered that Word document from Heerman's basement, that hard drive with the sections that allegedly outlined a lot of very specific things he tried to delete off of it as well. When evidence like that lands on a prosecutor's desk, what does that do to the trajectory of a case? And also, obviously, if it's on a prosecutor's desk, the defense knows that it's there too and that this is going to be part of the evidence. I mean, how do you, because you've seen both sides of this, how do you absorb that type of information? I mean, it seems like a slam dunk if you're the prosecutor, like, oh, he's got a document talking specifically about dismembering and doing these horrible things that were done to the victims. And then also, I have a client that has a document that talks about doing exactly what he's accused of doing. Not a good place to be in, Eric.
Yeah, as a prosecutor, it's kind of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and that's the golden ticket. I mean, that's going to take you to the promised land. That's essentially going to be construed as a confession. And confessions are some of the most compelling types of evidence. And so the weight of that alleged document cannot be overstated. Sure, there are ways to challenge it, but that is a tremendous problem for defense.
What would be a way you challenge it?
So a few things, especially with modern digital forensics, you know, you would look at who had access to the device from which that document was typed. You look at, you know, IP addresses. Where was that device? Where was that document generated? If you can look back that far, it depends on, right, on a number of factors. And then also you can look at, you know, whether there had been any modification or manipulation since the prosecution got it. Digital forensics folks could look at that. And if you find something suspicious or curious in terms of modifications that might be made, sometimes you can sort of try to hang your hat on that and further, right, open that hole, widen that, and allege that, hey, there's some fishy stuff going on the other side. Are you sure this document's authentic in its entirety? There are ways to do it, but it would be tough.
You know, I guess because if he wrote it and drafted it and they're able to show it in his secret hidey hole in his house where no one else had access, that was probably as damning as well.
that'd be a big problem. Yeah,
very much so. Well, so whole genome sequencing has never been admitted as evidence in a New York trial before this case. The judge ruled that, yes, it can be and would be certainly part of this. Now it gets to be someone else's battle, I guess, in another case to be admitted at another trial. You know, the fact that it was going to be admitted here, I guess there was a long fight of this, you know, over a long period of time. Should it be added? Should it be allowed? Should it not? It was allowed. Obviously, if the trial never takes place here, how does that affect other cases going forward in New York where they're going to eventually use this? Is because it's newer technology. Can they look back on this case and go, see, it was going to be admitted. They never actually used it. Or is it make it, a hotter potato for another case that could be attempted to be argued in another courtroom?
It's most certainly a precedent that has been set in New York. In that sense, this case is kind of historic. Now, because it was set by a trial judge, it would not be binding on any other trial judge. It would not be binding on an appellate court judge or a Supreme Court judge. So it's binding, but it's what's called persuasive authority. And that happens all the time when there are disputes about expert testimony and the attorneys say, hey, look, this judge said it was sufficiently reliable to admit. Our case is very similar. New judge, you should admit this. And we, you know, as practicing attorneys, we have a cachet of orders from judges on issues like this that we then cite to in subsequent cases saying, hey, look, this judge thought it was good enough. You should think it's good enough, too.
You know, it's really interesting. From what I've researched, again, this whole genome sequencing thing is new to me, too, because they're just rolling it out, right? But from what I understand, and Tony, you probably know more about this than I do, they got it. They're used because of the hairs, really, is because it's the first time they're actually able to extract the whole DNA sequence of someone from hair, and they couldn't do a typical DNA that's been done past cases. So just my thought experiment on this, as Huerman's learning about this whole DNA sequencing and seeing how sloppy he was with human hair for so long, maybe, again, part of that mental gyration he's doing about how to keep everything secret so he can keep it in his own little narcissistic head. He might have hairs all over that house or all over everything else that they'd be able to sequence, and he'd lose control. Again, I think it all comes back to that control.
Interesting. Yeah, technology. No, I hear you. You know, I think some of these folks are kind of detached from reality and have this delusion that they're smarter than everybody else, including the law. And when these revelations come out, it can be a bit of a reality check.
I still think that's a huge part of this case and other cases of serial killers that span decades, really, where you start your criminal enterprise of murdering people when technology was saying I can behave this way. The technology and forensics evolved, and they didn't.
There have been cases in the past where people have pled guilty and then have gotten out later because they found out somebody else did it and that they pled guilty for whatever reason they did at the time. You got seven murders here. So You could be, and I'm not saying this is, but I'm saying you could be looking at a scenario where he is responsible for like 5 of the 7 or 6 of the 7. You could be having one where maybe he isn't. They've argued for a long time. The very first victim from 93 was not him, but they did find a hair on that one. And that's how they connected that one. It's not a ton of evidence that connects Rex Heerman to his very first victim all the way back in 1993. Let's just, for the sake of argument, without getting into the weeds too much, let's say something happens here and somebody comes forward, or there's undeniable evidence that one of these 7 was not Rex Heerman, but for whatever reason, he's pleading guilty because he is responsible truly for 5 of the 7 or whatever it may be. Let's say that comes along in the coming years. What does that do to this? What does that do to this conviction or his guilty plea? Does that give him any sort of advantage down the line if he were to be like, you know what, maybe this was a bad idea. Maybe prison doesn't suit me so well. And then this person over here is truly responsible for this one that I pled to. And clearly it wasn't me. I've been saying that all along. I just did it to these. Is it where they can look back at it and go, well, yeah, you're still there for the other 6 and those all stand. Or does that blow the whole damn thing up and then have to make it be retried because they're all interconnected into one specific case, really? Another separate charges, but it's all in the one ruling.
Oh, that's a great question.
Totally. So the appellate courts usually favor finality. They don't like to reopen stuff. They don't like to send stuff back to the trial court, overturn convictions. They prefer to have this, you know, secured finality within these cases. So if that were to take place, I think that newly discovered exculpatory evidence is always a potential reason to withdraw a plea of guilty. And so would it be withdrawn? You know, it could be withdrawn with respect to that one specific killing. Could that cast further doubt on the other killings at a, you know, future appellate stage? It's at least possible. You know, Rex could say 5 years from now, if that were to happen, that, hey, actually, this other guy did this. When I copped to these pleas, I was not in my right mind. I had been in custody for a long time. My whole life had fallen apart and everything else. There's no certainty that all of the other convictions would be upheld, although an appellate court judge would, I believe, try to angle towards upholding the other convictions.
Now, is that something a defense attorney is going to counsel him on about a possibility of doing? Because again, these are questions I love throwing at Bob Mata too, is like, hey, or are they just going to do their job and grind it out and give him all these options? Or are they going to say to themselves, I'm not going to strategize that with him because he's a guilty douche?
You have to at least advise the client about, and I've had that conversation, not those specific words, but
it's my technical words.
You know, you have to advise the client as to post-conviction consequences, potential post-conviction remedies. So you can speak in broad general terms about it, but at the same token, if you're the lawyer and your client's going in there to plead guilty, you have to have a reasonable belief that that is a valid plea. And so you can't kind of be like, hey, if something, you know, great happens later for your case and you can try to, you know, wiggle out of this or something. You kind of have to go in there saying, hey, we are taking responsibility and we is the defense. And that implicates the attorney.
Right. And that's my question. Sorry, Tony, was because I love Tony's thought experiment on that. That's really intriguing. But same time, though, is that something a defense attorney, I guess, is really going to do in those circumstances, given the fact that, like you said, hey, if we're pleading guilty, that means we're taking ownership of it all. A good point.
Yeah. That's usually how it goes.
I mean, like in the Koberger situation where part of the stipulation was there's no going back here. Once you're pleading, you're done. There's no appeals. You're not allowed to appeal. I would imagine, I mean, do you see a world here where the judge is going to accept whatever agreement this is, where he doesn't remove all possibilities of any sort of parole or any sort of appealing this in any way, shape or form down the line, no matter what?
I think the prosecutor is going to be diligent in terms of divesting Rex Heerman of any potential rights down the road to try to undo this. That being said, the judge doesn't have complete control over what happens in the future. And if in your hypothetical, it was proven that someone else did at least one of these killings, even if the judge said, hey, there's no resentencing, there's no reconsideration of the plea, there's not going to be any of that, you don't have that right, I think... hypothetically, the Constitution would confer that right, and that would trump anything that is in the plea agreement or anything the judge order.
What do you think made him make this decision? Was it obviously just conjecture? Do you think it was him and his attorney sitting down, going, attorney having to come to Jesus meeting of like, look, we've lost everything that we've attempted to throw in front of this judge leading up to this trial. All of our motions have failed. All the things we try to get excluded are coming in. This is not going to go good. It's just not, Rex. And if you want anything, if you want to save a little bit of whatever exists for your family, whatever little bit of dignity you have left, you should probably plea. Or do you think this was Rex going to his attorney and saying, I'm out. I think we should end this right now. I did it. I mean, how do you think that went down behind closed doors?
I've got to imagine it was sort of at the attorney's behest, because yeah. Rex Hurlman just doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's going to like come out hat in hand and saying, oh, you know what? I'm going to do the right thing and take responsibility. And yeah. I'm going to, you know, save these victims' families, all of this nightmarish stuff that's going to happen at trial. He doesn't strike me like that kind of guy. Could have been, but I just don't know. I think the attorney is more like, hey, dude, we've exhausted all of our potential outs. You don't have any other outs, man. If you want to save, like you said, some modicum of dignity, some very trivial minor concessions that we might be able to build into it, now's your chance to do it. And that's how I imagine it went down.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, at some point Eric, I mean, do you see this at all in clients of any age where, I mean, Rex is an elderly, but, you know, he's getting more up there. You know, he's got a handful of good years left. Is there any correlation between an age at which someone says, screw it, I'm just whatever, I got 10, 20 years left. If I keep fighting this, I'm just going to be going in and out of courtrooms until I'm dead. Versus I'm going to make peace with this and I'm going to figure out what life is like behind bars. Do you ever see more backing down versus more fight depending on the age of the defendants?
Good question.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Totally. So, you know, you might have a 20-year-old client and let's say the evidence is significant and the offer is 5 years. Well, to a 20-year-old, 5 years, that's a quarter of their life. That seems like forever. They're yeah. like, hey, I'm going to throw away my life to do this. Let's fight this. Whereas if you're talking about someone in their 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, beyond, sometimes they do not have that. They have a different perspective.
Yeah.
Perspective in terms of time, in terms of headache, in terms of trauma. How shitty is this going to be for me? And is there a less painful alternative? I see that a lot more with folks who are up in age.
Interesting.
Except Donna Adelson.
Yeah. Well, Donna, I think, probably believes she will live forever. I think
that nutter.
You get deep down with her, I think she might think she's a deity of some sort. Digging. Yeah. Everybody's thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube on this segment. The links are in the descriptions.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruce and the Hidden Killers Podcast.